So I'm Will Drury. You've probably read the bios, but according to what I've gathered today, I'm an invertebrate, and I ship plastic bottles. So for the past decade or so, for the past 8 years, I've been shipping consumer products that usually is operating system, some application layer, and it actually has to go on a physical device. And I'm responsible for making sure those things happen all together with the security and privacy piecing together. And each one of the products or product lines I've worked on has been, they've chosen a different update strategy, some with more input from me and others with less. One product line updates every 6 weeks, full operating system, and can also do out-of-band security updates. But each one of those six-week updates are full feature and security mixed together. Another one of the products does monthly security fixes and more like quarterly cadence releases with larger yearly releases. And some of the smaller products, which probably none of you have seen, kind of did this somewhere in between, update on demand, but they had the infrastructure that was shared with the six-week system. And so that's the kind of perspective I come from. Can you hear me? If not, I will...
You're coming through in the microphone.
I can clip on too if that helps, because I might start moving. If you can't hear me again, tell me and I'll put on the other mic. I'll talk some about my experience specifically building. I'm a practitioner. Technology is what I do. So I'll talk some about that. But I think there are some technical problems that come up in the consumer electronic industry, and that's, I think, the first thing I want to say to this audience. And I think if you look at, if we expect an IoT maker or an OS vendor or anyone else to make a successful secure product, and there's a concern that updates might be a crutch because maybe they could be more secure, they could be like the electric delivery subsystem and do CMM level 5 and feel a lot more confident about what's going on. But if you were to try to do that today with the commercial off-the-shelf parts you can get, you're going to have a hard time. Even dedication isn't enough. And I think we can draw kind of a made-up example here that's the intersection of the things I've worked on. So if you want to build, a laptop or a phone that ships a web platform or an application, some sort of platform that application developers will write software for, and it evolves over time, it's feature-rich, so where do you start? So maybe you start with a browser, or you start with your application framework. And if you're careful, but you want to survive in the industry, so you want to have some speed, you might not write it, you might not rigorously test everything. But you'll have some investment, which I think has been talked to a good bit so far. But if you want that code to not be compromised all the time, you're probably going to use best practices like compartmentalization. You might sandbox it, isolate it, split up features. If you're serious about it, you might track how the information's flowing and make sure that different assets are available at different times. You could go to a lot of lengths there, but all of that compartmentalization has to be built on a foundation. I think Nico helped with this some, because you start building up and you look, I have a browser and it's using, processes to isolate different areas of risk. Those processes are constructs provided by the kernel, supported by the chips, but provided by the kernel. So you need to rely on this Linux kernel. In my case, all of the products I worked on use a Linux kernel, so your mileage may vary if you're using other kernels. But in that case, you kind of move up and you look at what is the perimeter of trust, the involvement of trust. And I think I don't have to speak to quite as much now, since there's already been some discussion over the broader community there and the lack of annotation of security-sensitive bugs. But I think you look at that, and I think that there's a good example of why, if I'm being responsible as a device maker, I want to be able to update my Linux kernel frequently. And in fact, it's a good argument for not having security-only updates, because if you don't know if any given bug is going to be security relevant in your context, you should just take everything at a reasonable, stable cadence and then keep going. Now that we're kind of at that point, you think, okay, go forth and do that. But you can't if you want to ship a product that's actually tied to hardware, because the SoC maker, the main processor maker, is going to provide some support in the kernel for you so that it can boot. Any peripheral vendors you have will provide drivers or other functionality. It may not be in the real Linux upstream. It may just be code they handed you and said, thanks for buying our part in the large volume scale. Here's some code. we're going to go move on to something else. So their incentive isn't long-term support for their main processors. It's not long-term support for the camera module. They're going to make a better camera next year, maybe two. So if you want a camera controller that has a certain image behavior, you get the one you get and you don't throw a fit. And so if you want to update your kernel, your choice is to re-implement their drivers, ask them for source code so you can manage it from there, or you have access depending on licensing situations, and invest there, or you just don't update. And if you look around the ecosystem of Linux devices, pay attention to the version number next to the Linux kernel. It's not going to be a high number. If you see something that says 4.4, you're really current because you aren't going to see that anywhere. And we're seeing 4.6 coming out now. So that's part of it, but it actually goes a little bit deeper because it's the Linux kernel. Like we continue down the stack, and it's not just the open source software. It's actually the software that comes from your chipset vendor. So when you buy a main processor from a mobile processor vendor or from a desktop processor vendor, you get silicon that does all sorts of cool, like awesome things, has an instruction set, but it's not actually locked in silicon. Most of that can be modified with software. And the first big scare that everyone had was when they realized that, say, Intel years ago released microcode updates. So it's a signed bit of code that if you cram it into the processor at the right time, changes how it interprets the very instructions that you expect to operate. So that was concerning, but you know, maybe we should have been more concerned about that than we were. We were like, okay, well, you're a silicon vendor, you do silicon, you do instructions, cool, we got this. They had some ways you can control it, so you can't always have the updates go in all the time, so we felt pretty good. But then you look at the other pieces and you realize that the vendors are actually selling full-featured operating systems that are called trusted or secure, that run in on ARM processors in TrustZone, but they call them trust execution environments. And my experience is that if trust is in the name of something, it's probably not trustworthy. So that's been pretty much the case so far. The chipset providers, they have a lot of software. It has to differentiate their silicon from other people. I guess that's hard to do in silicon. It's not my space, I don't know. But they do require the software. And in fact, you have to either, you can't even pay them to take it off. I keep trying. So I think that's a big question, and we're relying all the way down the stack on a large number of people, and I think there's lots of ways you can ameliorate that risk, but the further up you go, it gets harder. And so if we pop all the way back up and we look at the random product maker, let's say you're a Kickstarter, like, what do you do? You probably just grab some stuff and you throw it out there, and it's actually a pretty reasonable gamble because the amount of investment to do something better is huge. There's a huge gap there, and even when you do that, it's hard. So for the products I've worked on, we have to basically bidirectionally compartmentalize. So we start by compartmentalizing the stuff that we write and that we expect other people to write, and then we start isolating the kernel from the stuff we wrote and things other people write. And then we invest in efforts like the Kernel Self-Protection Project, funded by the CII, partly. Thank you. Which tells the kernel how to protect itself. But to get those new features, we have to get kernel updates. So it gets messy. But yeah, I think, so you end up looking at a situation where you have to have a huge investment to ship a product that you might feel vaguely proud of. Either one path is CMM level 5, and you just, features be damned, like, this is good. It works once in 20 years. I hope it'll still work the same way. Or you have this off the shelf and you just kind of keep working. So I think that puts some of this investment in perspective. I think, and that's kind of the next section I think worth talking about is, I thought I'd have to talk more about this, but having had OS vendors and device makers, everyone else talk about this first, I can kind of skip ahead. But the investment that we're seeing everyone make around the room is in a secure development lifecycle, automated testing, test labs. And then that's just like code assurance. If you want to talk about the servers, let's say you're shipping maybe 580 megabyte updates on the regular, just say, that's a lot of bandwidth. And even if you're able to get those updates down to smaller numbers, you have to pay for that bandwidth. You have to encourage people to take it, so you need to work on ways to make your updates low friction. They can't move the cheese for users too frequently. They can cause instability. And I think that there's also key management. So multiple people have talked about signing. So you have to sign your images. You may also have web servers that are HTTPS. So you've got keys. You might keep them air-gapped. It maybe has a secure room. You've got to get 4 out of 8 people to come in there with their key cards. So now we have to have more people, more technology. And all of these pieces and processes are expensive just to get a modicum of assurance. And I think that's it was nice seeing that. I was kind of going to highlight these things, but actually seeing a lot of people around the room say that this is exactly what they're doing is both great and also terrifying. Right? It's a huge expense. But I think one of the areas we haven't talked about as much, and I've spent a lot of time on, is the client side. So if you have updates that are secure and they're served securely or metadata is secure, you've got signing keys, you've got good processes, you still have to deliver them to the client. And the client has to know what to do with them. So you have an update agent, for lack of a better description. It has to run on your platform. It has to reach out to the internet. It has to decide, do I have a secure connection with a remote party, or do I care? Do I need a secure connection? It needs that connectivity component. So it might be Wi-Fi, it might be Bluetooth, it might be Ethernet. So you have a whole stack that you have to implement to make sure that's robust. Comes up early enough, you can get boot. You can get it reasonably quickly after boot, and can then take and apply that. So it has to have privilege too, because it has to be able to write to the locked devices on disk that store your OS image. And with so personally, we shipped one update early on with Chromebooks. I think it was released 19 or something. And every time you boot, you go to login screen. If you were an enterprise customer and you'd been getting management from us, there was a case we hadn't caught in automated testing where you couldn't actually log in after your update. So that was kind of a bad place to be. But we were like, okay, well, we'll fix this. Once we realized there was a problem, we could kind of release a new version that undid what we'd done until we could kind of sort it out. But our update engine had been designed early enough that it comes up, Wi-Fi comes up. You're seeing that login screen, it's already asking for the update. And so we had to ask a number of people to hold tight, don't shut it off, update's coming. And then when a little update arrow comes up, they hit it and things resume. And so I think it's not specifically security, but there's a huge investment in that design area where how do you piece together the core of a system that is connected and depends on updates. And so as you keep kind of moving down, back down towards chipsets again, and we look at what we're doing with those updates. So when we write them to disk, we can't really inherently trust the disk that our software is on, because if an attacker has access to it, they can change the bits. And so when you boot up, you actually have to go through and verify it. Now, Windows 10 recently added the Windows Trusted Boot. TiVo, of TiVoization fame, used to run a little thing off their signed kernel that scanned the file system and picked their favorite files and checked them to make sure they hadn't been changed, which was incomplete. So it wasn't entirely TiVoized. But you have to do something to make sure that what you put on that disk at some time point A, after reboot at time C, is still the same. And so that's why we do all the signing. That's why we don't just check the signature at load time, but we check it every time you boot. And you want to check everything that's executable, ideally, and any critical configuration data if possible. And one of the areas that's important to hit on is that rollback protection is actually somewhat difficult. So when you want to take a random image, let's say you've got a new kernel or new OS version 5, and you go to version 6, and you want to store safely in a tamper-evident or a tamper-resistant way that you've moved to the new version and consider that version good, where do you store that on the system? If you get a modern Intel processor, a modern ARM core, where do you store data that you consider sensitive? And the answer that's been developing recently is that you store it on your storage device. Storage device, like any flash-based ones now, support a replay-protected memory block, which requires that you have this like transitive secret that the CPU has somewhere in a fuse, or electronic fuse, and that it knows how to talk to the RPMB and write data there. RPMB itself is built on a software system that is the firmware of the flash controller that has to know how to do encryption, can talk over the bus to the processor. And so now you've got, in order just to have a replay protection for the special information that's that you have for booting the system, you have a whole other operating system doing the work there. So that gets really hard. And I'm not a hardware person, so I spent a couple of years asking people, like, why can't we just have a few bits of storage in the processor? And so I'll share this nugget. I'm sure many people here know, but essentially processors run at a process size that's much smaller than flash. So you can't ask a chip maker to put flash in their chip because they'll say, we can't do it. But because of that, we lack this essentially critical secure storage for making decisions about the policy of how as we boot. And I think in order to solve that problem, we become more dependent on third parties that are kind of part of our trusted relationship. So I think those are probably kind of some of the main kind of technical areas that we're talking about. But there are a lot of kind of open issues that people have mentioned that we're still running into. And I think a big one that I've personally struggled with is the single signer problem, where update abuse is always possible in these scenarios. Like, we're protecting users from attackers that we haven't authorized, but we haven't actually solved the problem of protecting them against us. So what if we're compelled to update? What if we're compromised? What if it, no matter what level of controls we have, what if one bit error has been introduced somewhere that is critical in the right context? It's hard to catch it. And is there anything we can do? I think proactively, we've done our best to limit that by making it hard to do targeted attacks. We want to make it easy to identify a specific user when we're delivering an update. We want to make that as generic as possible. And unfortunately, actually identifying people on the internet is easier than you ever want it to be, because you get a few bits of data, and you get an IP address, and you get a country, and you're like, well, there's only one Chromebook owner in Romania, so I know who you are, probably. I think it gets trickier to do that, but the intent is there. If you don't build the unique identity into the system, then you can keep pushing further back on what you know. And that makes it harder to target someone with an attack. And I think the slip then from there is to move over to, I guess, reactive mechanisms. And this has come up a few times now. And I think the idea with IoT and being able to know, are you up to date? I think the idea of having transparency and what binaries are being delivered and available is an excellent kind of reactive mechanism. It's not proactive. It doesn't protect a user from compromise or from abuse, but it does mean that it makes covert action a little bit more difficult if there is a public distributed log of what's available and what's out there. But it's not clear. So this is one area where I'm hoping maybe there is actually a good proactive answer. Enterprises often do double signing, or they'll delay a release, but if that's not practical, and they're not really going through and like combing the source or the binary to understand, was it a compiler compromise from GCC upstream that then merged its way down through the compiled kernel? You just don't know. So I think that's open. And one of the other areas, since I have 1 minute, is looking at the incentives around how we get people to make the effort. So I don't even know how to change chip makers. That's out. Maybe I'll get a promotion if I figure that one out. But I think there's incentives for like getting people to want to build systems that are secured. And I mean, there are definitely a lot of sticks, and regulatory can be both sides of that. But I think on the incentive side, there's a large opportunity. In fact, the very chip makers who are giving us these operating systems that are trusted, whatever, could be providing a baseline toolkit that we're actually building on that is robust and sound, that would make it easy for, let's say, a Kickstarter project to build a secure platform. They're not, but if they were, that's possible. So there's room in the industry to provide these tools. And I hope places like Linux Foundation are able to help enable that, and big companies when they're incentivized as well. But that's kind of one of the few ways I've seen to open that up. Rather than ramble on, I'll open it to questions.